This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm in studio with the show's producer, Carrie Jr. II.
How are you doing, Stephen?
Good, Carrie. So one of the things that is toughest to deal with, I think, in life, of course, is grief and the grief of loss when mm-hmm. we lose somebody really close to us. And it's, of course, there's the instant grief that you feel, but often there's this prolonged difficulty that people have with coming to terms with the person who's gone. A little later this year, I will mark the 40th anniversary of my dad dying. And, you know, 40 years is a long time.
Wow.
And I was very young. I was a young teenager. And I can't say that it's any easier now to think about that or to understand everything that it means than it was when I was 14. I mean, a lot has changed in my life, of course, mm-hmm. over that period of time, but it's not any easier. And I think that's pretty common, that whole that sense of something missing doesn't go away, and you don't ever truly figure out how to make sense of it.
I'm wondering if for you it's been easier to deal with the grief of losing him versus dealing with not having him at all. Is there a difference there? Like, I'm wondering if it's like the day-to-day of coming to terms with him being gone is different than having to deal with living life without your father.
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, when I think about him, often I think about all the things that he has essentially missed.
Mm-hmm.
He never saw me drive a car,
right.
for instance. He never saw me graduate from high school or college.
Mm-hmm.
He's never met my children. He mm-hmm. didn't meet mm-hmm. the person I was married to. You know, all the most significant things in my life, he was
really
gone for.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, as you get older and have more experiences, all of those things make it more difficult. As you add these other things to your life, mm-hmm. the missing part becomes a dimension of those things that is darker than it should be. So, you know, I think this is a pretty common experience. It's just hard. You don't always know how to manage it.
And to recognize and see as you continue to live on, the moments that person is no longer witnessing with you has got to be a difficult experience.
Yes. Yes.
Our guest for this episode has also experienced that grief of losing a parent, but she speaks about, in this particular discussion, about the loss of her husband. That's someone you have agreed is going to live out the rest of your life experiences to a point alongside you. And to mm-hmm. have lost that person, I imagine, also kind of has to feel that same way. And so our guest for this show, she had that experience, and she also wrote a book highlighting what that was like for a lot of other, particularly women as well. Her name is Lori Tucker Sullivan. She's a music writer and author. She wrote a book called I Can't Remember If I Cried, Rock Widows on Life, Love, and Legacy. And she details in this book interviews that she had with a number of widows of rock musicians and a little bit more complex level of grief, right? It's not just that they lose that person, but they have to deal with the aftermath of their fame or their finances or the relationships that they had with their band members. And so she ends up detailing like how all of those things come together and make grief more complicated.
Yeah. You know, for us here, I think the issue crystallizes around this idea of managing change, mm-hmm. which is a part of American life, and it's a difficult part of American life, and it gets to, you know, equality issues in some ways. How do we make ourselves whole? How do we make sure people can be whole when the things that are critical in their lives go away and are no longer there? Lori Tucker Sullivan, great to have you here in the studio. Thank you for coming to talk with us on Created Equal.
Thanks for having me, Stephen. It's good to talk with you.
So I think the concept of this book is super, super interesting. And then the subjects that you include in the book are also super interesting. All of the widows you spoke with. But there's something about it that I think I don't quite understand how it connects with you and your story. Why you chose Rock Widows to highlight the grief process and talk about your own grief with the loss of your husband. So I guess I want to start here. Tell me about your late husband, Kevin, what brought you together and how you lost him and how that brought you to this idea of how people grieve a lost spouse.
Gosh, okay, so we'll jump right in. So Kevin and I married quite early. I'm a Detroit native, born and raised here. And so, of course, music was something that we shared.
It's everywhere in Detroit.
It is. It is. It's part of your DNA in Detroit, which I feel very fortunate to have been here all those years. And, we saw concerts together. We shared music with each other. We introduced each other to new music. And music was a part of our lives as we married and started a family. For me, I had always had a dream of writing about music. Certainly, having Cream Magazine in Detroit, there's a lot of great music journalism here. Both newspapers had great music journalists. And so that was kind of an aspiration of mine, but it got set aside when I got married and we bought an old farmhouse just outside of Ann Arbor, renovated that house, started having kids, and the whole idea of following rock stars around the country didn't seem too compatible with that. So I turned my writing to more public relations, marketing, and had kind of this longing to write, to really spend more time writing, to make it something more than just a hobby that I did when, in spare moments, which there aren't many when you're at that point in your lives. But I really wanted to return to that. And we came to an agreement that I would go back to school, and I started working on my master's degree. And after the first, about halfway through the second semester of that study, Kevin was diagnosed with head and neck squamous cell carcinoma. Mm. So just when I thought I was going to, kind of reach that point of having it all that we were all told we could do, it was kind of pulled out from under us. And so I became a full-time caregiver. It was about a 2.5-year battle. The first round went pretty well. We thought he was cured and we could move on with things. I could head back to school, but then it returned. And once it returned, really, that was it. So we were just past our 26th anniversary when he passed away. He was about 6 weeks shy of his 50th birthday. Mm. And I just had to figure out my purpose going forward. In addition to Kevin, my father passed away the year before he did. My mother about 1.5 years after. I sold the house. I couldn't keep all of that work on my own. My kids were going off to college. So all of the ways really in which I had identified myself were going away, were being taken from me. And I had to come up with some kind of new identity. Mm. And I, on the way to class, Kevin made me promise that I would finish my degree. And so on the way to my last class, I heard a story about Yoko Ono. And I thought that I think very differently about her now. I have a very different attitude about her because we shared this thing in common. And if ever there were women who had to build a new identity after the loss of a husband or partner, it was someone like her.
Sure.
And so I thought there must be others as well, because there are so many musicians and rock stars that died young. So I went in search of them. That was really what, how it all kind of started.
Yeah.
And once I heard the first couple stories, then I knew that I was, at first I started wanting to meet them just to tell them my story, to share that story with them, to learn about them. I didn't know if it would be a book. I certainly didn't have a publishing deal at that point. After the first couple stories, I knew that I was on to something.
You're just kind of following the way you felt.
Yeah, yeah. And I knew that they had something to teach me. And they were so generous, and no one had asked for their stories before. And so suddenly, instead of being adrift, I had this new purpose. Mm-hmm. It was really pretty amazing.
You know, I think it's really interesting that it's music that kind of leads you along this path, even though you weren't a professional musician and weren't a professional music writer. But you talk about music being a central part of the relationship with your husband. I wonder if you can tell us more about that. Is there an album? Is there a concert? Is there an artist that you think captures the relationship that the two of you had over music? I think that music is such a central part of so many people's relationships, but there's always a center of that, a thing that defines it.
Yeah, that's a little difficult to come down to one or two.
Yeah, no, right.
And you know, people have asked how I selected the women that I wanted to interview, mm-hmm. and I prioritized them originally by those whose music was most important to us.
Okay.
So and not all of them are in the book. On our third date, we went out to a high school in Grand Rapids and saw The Clash. That was a pretty defining moment.
Yeah, what year was that?
Oh gosh, 1980,
wow,
I think.
Wow, okay, so that's pretty early for The Clash,
yeah,
too.
Yeah,
right?
It was. And 80, 81, I would say, because we met the summer of 81, so it would have been right around there. And yeah, so certainly that was very important. That band was very important to us. Warren Zevon, a singer-songwriter, mm-hmm. Kevin said I was the first person he dated that actually knew who Warren was. We saw him multiple times. The Pretenders was also another early concert that we saw here in Detroit. So those were some of the bands that early on linked us to each other. And then as we grew, as our family grew, you know, Saturday mornings listening to more kind of singer-songwriters like Harry Chapin, Jim Croce, that music became important as well. I don't want to say we aged, but I guess we kind of, you know, we settled down a little bit from The Clash to Jim Croce. It's quite
happens.
A jump, but yes.
Yeah, your tastes change.
Right, right.
As you go through life. You know, I'm also curious about the career that you imagined that you might have as a music writer. Of course, writing for Cream is itself an experience, and I'm sure we can sit here and talk a lot about the things you saw and experienced there. But I guess I'm more interested in the disappointment of that for you, that it wasn't what you imagined that it would be, and that you walked away from it, and I guess how that changed the role that music was going to play in your professional life, but maybe also altered the way you felt about music and musicians.
Yeah. I think the easy story is to say that I met my husband while I was in college. We kind of took this other path, and so it wasn't compatible.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, my experience there was that I would take my clips from college. I worked on the college newspaper and interviewed, and I worked at the Hyatt Regency during college. And so I actually interviewed some bands as I checked
there.
Them in yeah. to the at the front desk. Yeah. So, and I would take those clips, and really what I was told by the editors at Cream was, this is good stuff. Go out and write something that we can publish. And it was lacking that nerve. I mean, all respect to the women there who got those stories, because it wasn't in
easy.
My personality to do that. Yeah, and I realized that. And so as much as I think choosing that path put me in a different direction, also my kind of lack of being really gutsy in this kind of situation, which is what it takes to be in those rooms, to be backstage, to be asking those questions. That really wasn't me at that time.
Yeah. What was it, nervousness about these encounters, or was there something else?
Yeah. No, I think a lot of it was nervousness. I had a conversation once with Dave Marsh, which I saw him many years later when he was in Detroit, and he didn't recall it, which I wasn't surprised. But he said, you can't be a critic and a fan. And you know, I was a fan. Yeah. I was very much a fan. And I think this book has allowed me to get to know these men as both the writer and a fan in a way that I couldn't before.
Yeah.
So it really kind of answered that question for me.
I mean, there's also something kind of circular about this. I mean, you lose music professionally at that point, and then you lose your husband later, and then you rediscover or maybe regain music in the way that you decide to write about all of this.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, very much. I've regained it in my life. Yeah. And still, and I think maybe even more, have respect for those who go out and get these stories, especially the women who do it.
Yeah. So this idea of profiling the women who are in rock and roll and lose their husbands, I wonder what that initially does for you, the grieving process for you at that point. How does it kind of bring you to that revelation that this was the way to really think about that grief?
I think there are grief groups, there are books that you can read, and they tell you how you should grieve. They tell you kind of the normal ways that people grieve. But for me, listening to these stories of these women, stories where, you know, they had everything one day and nothing the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Stories that really put these men in perspective, a perspective I didn't have before. I think all of those things helped me in my own grieving process. Crystal Zevon's lesson in forgiveness will stick with me for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. And you know, my relationship with my husband was wonderful. I didn't experience any of the things that she did. But were there things that we never talked about before he passed away? Yes. You know, the fact that he never quite came to terms with his dying, the fact that he was dying, kind of left a residue of anger with me and something that I had to resolve. And so I learned those lessons from these women because they had done them themselves. They had gone through it. And just with such grace and strength, and I've learned from all of them.
Yeah. Did you feel like the process for you had not been graceful? Had it been difficult to kind of reconcile all these things before you found this way to do it through these other women?
I think for me, I just kept moving forward. And I think that's the way a lot of women deal with grief. You know, I interviewed Ingrid Croce. I say in the book, and it has not previously been too public, but Ingrid now has aphasia, so it's very difficult for her to talk. And she was mostly silent throughout the day, saying yes and no, shaking her head. We pored over some journals. We looked at some early writing that she had done. Her husband, Jimmy Rock, was there, and he helped fill in a lot of the information. And then I said, you know, the most important question for me in these interviews always is, what were those first weeks and months like for you? Mm. For me, they were very difficult. And I just want to share your story. And this woman who had not really spoken just looked at me and said, I had a child to raise, and he had to have breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day. And I couldn't let him down. I had to keep going. And it was, you know, it was just kind of shocking to hear her say that, both because she wasn't physically able to say anything earlier, but also because that getting that message out was so important to her that she got beyond physical limitations to say it. And it was just, you know, again, another moment that will always stick with me. But I think that is the way women, especially women who are married and have children, that's the way we do it.
To manage the world,
we,
right?
Yes, and we have, you know, kids to raise and houses to keep and jobs to do. And so we just keep going. And before you know it, a year has passed, a year and a half has passed. And you just, you keep that going. You cry when you need to, you get angry, you know, you have those moments. And many of us do have those other, you know, elderly parents to care for as well, and all of these other things now. It's a lot. And we don't make room for grief as we should.
Yeah. Okay, we need to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will continue talking with Lori Tucker Sullivan about her book, I Can't Remember If I Cried, Rock Widows on Life, Love, and Legacy. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. We're back with more Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and today we're talking with Lori Tucker Sullivan. She is a music writer and the author of a book called I Can't Remember If I Cried, Rock Widows on Life, Love, and Legacy. Lori, I want to talk a little about that title. It comes, at least in part, from the Don McLean song "American Pie," which I have to say I know as a closing song in bars, right? In the 1980s and 90s. I shouldn't say 80s because I wasn't legally allowed to be in bars in 80s, even though I was. But you know, as the hour approached 2 a.m. or whenever the place was supposed to stop selling liquor and send everybody home, they would put that song on and everyone would sing at the top of their lungs. And it's this very long narrative that that has a lot of historical references. Mm-hmm. And it really occupies a place in not just rock history, but kind of American history, I think, in the way that yes. that story is told. But I wonder what you make of that lyric. I mean, there's something very sad about that lyric, and there's something very sad about that part of the song. Why did you choose it for yes. the book?
Well, the full line is, I can't remember if I cried when I read about his widowed bride. And it's about Maria Elena Holly, who is the widow of Buddy Holly, and I believe the first rock widow. And Maria Elena doesn't talk to many people these days. So I did approach her and was not able to get an interview. But, you know, she was pregnant at that time and heard about his death on the radio mm-hmm. and subsequently lost their child. Mm. And so I think she is also a symbol of what all of these women still go through. It happened again in the 70s with Ronnie Van Zant and Lynyrd Skynyrd. It happened, you know, since then it has happened. And now in the age of getting the story first and getting it, you know, out on the internet, it's impossible to prevent it. There were guidelines that went into place to try to prevent that from happening after Buddy Holly's death. Mm-hmm. And now I think those have just really gone out the window. So it's something that these women still battle. And she's kind of a symbol of that, the start of it.
Yeah. And you were talking in the earlier segment about the need that women feel to just go on and continue to manage life and continue to manage other people's lives after they lose a spouse. This lyric kind of points to that in some way. I can't remember if I cried. This idea of kind of soldiering on and moving past these things without appropriate time for grief.
Yes, yes. And I think, too, the lyric, you know, is really from the point of view of a fan saying that he can't remember if mm-hmm. he cried when he heard about this. Mm-hmm. And that opens up a whole new area of discussion of how these women deal with fans who are quite often obtrusive and cross lines and feel they have some ownership and some right to to memories or to, you know, or to actual possessions of these people. So yeah, there's that too. But yeah, it really, the lyric kind of came to me, and I wanted to use it as the epigraph in the book, and I still didn't have a title. And then I thought, that is the title.
That's so common that the thing you're looking for is actually right in front of you.
Yes.
It's just doing something else right. than what you imagined it could. I do want to talk a lot about the women that you chose for the book. And let's start with how you chose them. Were these women whose stories had spoken to you before, or did they jump out at you because of what you were trying to do here?
A combination of those. So I first made the list of musicians and rock stars that had died at a young age that were married or had a partner. Mm-hmm. And then I started looking into them. And in some instances, they were out there because they had their own careers, their own lives. Gloria Jones is an example of that. And again, prioritized them a little bit around those people whose music was important to me and to us, and wanting to hear those stories. So I think the first four or five that I did were Gloria, Peggy Sue, Honeyman Scott, Crystal Zevon, and Sandy Chapin, mm-hmm. And a kind of combination of, you know, I knew that Sandy had worked very hard to preserve Harry's legacy and all of the work that he did. He was, you know, known at the time of his death as much for his work in building up nonprofits and preventing hunger and things like that as he was as a musician. And so that was of interest to me. And once I started kind of digging a little and finding their stories, again, I knew that these were stories that needed to be out there, needed to be told.
Yeah. So let's start talking about Crystal Zevon, who you've already mentioned, and what defines, I guess, or drives her struggle with grief after her husband, who's not her husband when he dies,
right.
does pass away.
Yeah. You know, they had a difficult marriage. There was physical abuse within that marriage, but there was also this lasting love at first sight. And neither of them remarried after they divorced. She moved away from him to kind of start all over and let him deal with things. But then as soon as he was given a stage 4 diagnosis, he called her and asked her to care for him.
Yeah.
And that's not uncommon, actually, for people who have separated or divorced to come back together when death is imminent. Mm-hmm. And so she kind of had to wrestle with that. Did she really want to go back and get involved with him? And he did start drinking again. He made his last album that he really willed himself to live through making that album and seeing his grandchildren born. And then he asked her before he died to write his biography. And in doing so, she had to go through boxes and boxes of journals that he wrote throughout his life. Mm-hmm. And he wrote about, you know, the kind of mustard that he had on a sandwich. And he also wrote about her, and he wrote about his affairs. And he, it was very difficult. One of the most poignant lines, I think, in the book is when she says reading his journals was like getting punched in the face all over again. Mm-hmm. And then after, you know, when she read them all, she realized that it was also his one last ask for forgiveness, his one last kind of request for absolution. And it was a gift that she gave herself to do that for him.
What do you mean by that?
He's not here, you know, so she can be angry with him forever, mm-hmm. but being at peace with him and with their life was the better thing for her.
Was for her.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a lot to forgive.
It is. Yeah. It is. I think for so many people in relationships, that's some part of the grieving process is coming to the space where you can forgive the person, maybe just for leaving, even, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Has that been some of what you've had to contend with?
Personally, mm-hmm. myself, mm-hmm. A little bit. I mean, I think my anger is more directed at the universe for that. But there are certainly times when I think about where I'm at and how different it would be if I still had my partner here. There are many times when I'm out with friends and I'm the seventh person in the group. And those times are few and far between. I think I'm, doing pretty well. But yes, there is that anger that sometimes is hard to even place. Why did this happen to us? You know, I had a husband who was young, who was healthy, he ran marathons, and yet he developed a smoker's cancer, which, how did that happen?
Right. An incredible unfairness.
Yes, there is. For many, many people.
Who are some of the other women who you think kind of stand out in the book? I've got a list too, but I want to give you a chance to highlight some of the ones that really matter to you.
Gretchen Parsons Carpenter mattered a lot. Graham's music was something that Kevin and I had discovered. I still remember we took a trip, just the two of us, to Toronto, and we were in a music store, and I picked up a CD of a tribute CD to Graham, and there were musicians on that tribute CD that I recognized, and so I thought, I'll try this and take a listen, and that, led us down the path to listening to his music, and so I was very interested in talking with her, but she had never spoken to anyone. And she makes very clear that this is her story and she's not going to wade into the mess that other people have made. And so she was the second or third interview that I did. I went to her home. Here we are on the patio overlooking Laurel Canyon, and it's just a beautiful setting. And again, I learned these lessons from her and learned, first of all, how very young she was, how young Graham was. Here's a 20-year-old woman, young woman, who meets this man at a party for the Rolling Stones that she kind of wanders into as a fluke. A friend is there and calls her over, and he's gorgeous, he's wealthy, he's Harvard educated, at least for a year, and then he dropped out. He's in a band, he writes wonderful music, he's, musically close to a genius, mm-hmm. And very charismatic. And they become a couple, and then he becomes a heroin addict, essentially, and she is left at, 21, 22, to cope with all of this. Mm-hmm. And since his death, has become kind of known as the jealous wife, who, she's blamed for things that at the time, my children were in their early 20s, and I thought neither of them, I have a son and a daughter, neither of them could cope with this.
Sure.
And I have a friend who is a journalist who, when I told her Gretchen was one of the people I interviewed, she said, she's kind of always been the widow Parsons. Like, she has never quite moved on from this. And then she read the chapter and she said, I owe her an apology. I can't imagine now being that young, being pulled into this life and having to deal with it all. And then trying your best to move on. And she's been quite successful at that. But circumstance pulls her back into this because he has become the thing of legend.
Yes.
The whole story around what happened before his burial is just an amazing story. And
tell our listeners just a little of what happens there.
So Gretchen wanted to take his body back to New Orleans. They had spent time there. They were married there. And as his body was on the tarmac at LAX, ready to go there, it was stolen by his kind of manager, and taken out to Joshua Tree, which is where he was when he overdosed, and lit on fire. And they supposedly had a pact where this would happen, whichever one of them went first. They didn't want a maudlin funeral. Yes, yeah. With people crying. And it's become, this thing of legend, and people don't realize that there are people with feelings behind this.
There's human damage.
Yes, that had to live through this.
I mean, that's a common theme in the book, mm-hmm. in the chapters, the difficulty that these women faced while their partners were alive, the role that they were often forced into or felt trapped in as the spouse to a very talented and very famous man, and the way in which that becomes more complicated in death it's all over the place. I mean, the stories are all very different, but they have very, very common themes.
Yes, they do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the question is, do you stay? Do you go? Do you look for this person's better self that you know is there? Do you fight to try to bring him back to that? Mm-hmm. Do you walk away? Mm-hmm. There's no easy answer. People are advising you. It's very difficult.
Yeah.
And I think we don't think of that human toll.
Mm. Who's your favorite in the book? I know it's an unfair question.
Yeah, it is.
But I'm going to ask it anyway. You won't answer. Well, let me ask it this way. Which story do you think has the most resonance or power in the book?
So for me, as I've done events, people have asked favorite interview, and I don't have one. I really don't have one.
It's not
every
a fair
experience
question. I gotta
was
ask it.
Yes, was very special. But the I guess the story with the most resonance for me personally, and the one that was hardest for me, was actually Catherine Mayer. Catherine was married to Andy Gill. Andy founded Gang of Four, post-punk band in the UK. He was brilliant. Again, so many of these men are quite brilliant. And he went on to produce a lot of music. And he was on tour in late 2019, early 2020, on tour in China and throughout Asia, but particularly in China, came home and had some autoimmune issues and lung issues throughout his life, but then became sicker and sicker. And he developed what they thought was pneumonia. Mm. Now Catherine believes that it was COVID. I met her. I had flown in to London overnight and had about an hour of sleep, and then had this interview with her. Why I scheduled it on my first day, I don't know. But then there was a transit strike, so I had to walk and find her home. And it was Andy had built a studio in the basement, so we went in and looked at his studio where the Red Hot Chili Peppers had recorded and Michael Hutchence had recorded. And so there's this sense of awe. And then she tells me the story, and she comes to the point where Andy would never come to terms with the fact that he was dying. Mm. He died, shortly after the start of COVID, and she's already written a book about it because she is also a journalist. She is a political correspondent. She has covered wars. So that was also a bit intimidating.
Yeah.
She's a wonderful writer. She's and just a truly lovely person. And she wrote about Andy's inability to come to terms with this, that he wanted his laptop when the ambulance is there and they're taking him to the hospital. And he wanted a glass of wine, and she said no, and she feels guilty about that. And the line that she wrote in the book is that he would continue to kind of create this fictive future until his last breath.
Yeah.
And that, I went through that exact experience. Kevin was making plans to go back to his job the day before he died, and he was quadriplegic at that point and on oxygen. And there just was no facing what was going to happen for him. Yeah. And I have come to terms with that. Mm-hmm. He did what he had to do in the way he had to do it. And
but again, so there's an effect.
There is
on
an effect.
This other person on
yes.
you.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. We didn't have those talks that we should have. And you know, I'm making it very clear, and I'm leaving stuff for my kids. I don't want them to go through that. And I think that's an important thing. And the reason Catherine wrote the book was because we have to talk about this. It happens to all of us. Mm-hmm. And we need to be better prepared. We need to break these taboos about talking about our end of life.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was a particularly difficult one.
Yeah. Okay, we need to take another quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue talking with Laurie Tucker Sullivan, music writer and author of I Can't Remember If I Cried, Rock Widows on Life, Love, and Legacy. Stay where you are. We'll be back with more Created Equal. We're back with more Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and our guest is Laurie Tucker Sullivan. She's a music writer and author of a book titled I Can't Remember If I Cried, Rock Widows on Life, Love, and Legacy. Laurie, I want to talk about the role that this book plays and doing this book plays in your grief and helping you to make sense of the things that you felt when your husband Kevin died, and that you feel, and that you feel now.
Okay,
it's a big question.
It is. So, what is the question there?
No.
How?
What role does having done this book play in all of that?
It certainly has given me new purpose, and I think that has. You know, it's returned me to the things that I kind of went away from as a young person. So I do feel that full circle kind of feeling. And it has really made me feel like a writer. Hmm. And that's not an easy thing either.
No.
You know, a lot of imposter syndrome, especially once you set it aside and try to come back to it later.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that's really been a wonderful gift of this. And just those connections. You know, I sent the book off to my publisher, to my editor, and it was a couple weeks before he got back to me. And he had to read the whole book because I did 24 interviews and only 14 made it into the book. Mm-hmm. So there may be a volume two. but, it, you know, in those weeks, I, of course, thought he hates it. He's trying to figure out how to get his advance back. I need to find something else to do.
Yeah.
But then he came back and said, you know, the connections here, the things that they've shared are really part of that connection that they had with you, that shared vulnerability. And it's really, you know, quite beautiful. And
it is very powerful.
Yeah.
How much you got each of these women to open up
yes.
about
yes.
Not just the relationship they had with their spouse, but how they managed the loss of mm-hmm. that person and the consequences of it.
Yes. Yes. For some of them, it took years, and I think that vulnerability is there on the page, and so that has really been impactful for me and for others who've read the book.
Yeah,
it's a music book, but it, you know, it is kind of a grief book
uh-huh.
too.
Yeah, I was going to ask you: do you feel like it fits in one category more than the other? There are some incredible music stories
yes,
in
there
here
are.
And things yeah. that at least I had not seen about the artists in other spaces. But that's not really what you're trying to do
right,
in the book, right?
Yeah, yes. No, I really wanted them. And people who have read it have said, you know, this is not the how-to book. It's how it's been done by women who were in very difficult circumstances. And gosh, if they did it, I can do this. I can do this. And so that's, you know, that's really heartening to me to know that people get that out of it.
It's also interesting to me that for you, this plays out in this very gendered space. Women who were married to, you know, again, very talented, very famous men, and lost them and how they dealt with it. And I wondered, as I was, you know, reading through the book, what the flip side of that would even look like. I mean, men lose spouses too.
Yes.
And it would look different for many reasons, but I found myself wondering what men might draw out of this book, given that it's not really about us.
No, it's
which
not.
Which is okay.
It's not.
That's okay too.
The publisher sent a few cover designs for me, and one of them was the man playing guitar on a stage. And I said, no, I reject this out of hand. No, it's not about the men. It's about the women.
Yeah.
And finally, they've been asked for their stories. They haven't been asked previously.
Right.
They were closest to these men, and they have never been asked.
Yeah. What do you imagine that readers of this book, whether they are men or women, might take away from it that might help them with the grief that they may have in their own lives?
I hope they take away from it that regardless of the depth of your loss, you can keep going. You can find purpose. You can find new love. Mm-hmm. You can find reasons to keep going. I hope they take from it that there are people who 10, 15 years on still have grief in their lives, mm-hmm. but it's not the central focus of their lives. That they understand that it changes them in certain ways, and they can carry it with them, and they will carry it with them, but it doesn't define them forever.
Yeah.
And they can, they can be strong and keep going.
Talk about the things that for you are maybe still difficult. I mean, it's very obvious that thinking of this book, doing the interviews, publishing this book has brought you to a new space in the way that you think of your husband and his loss. But what are the difficult days that still exist around that? Like,
The difficult days are when I realize that, there's so much that he's missed. My son and daughter-in-law just had their second anniversary. Mm. He missed that wedding. Mm. You know, he's missed graduations and all of those kind of life things. And that's not fair. He should be here.
Mm-hmm.
I left the farmhouse and I moved back to Detroit, and I know that he would have just loved it here and loved the friends that I have now. And so that's the difficult thing when you just come back to that unfairness. It'll never not be unfair that he's not here.
Yeah. Do the interviews in the book help put that in perspective?
Yes. Yes. It has given me really good company because they, so many of them don't think it's fair either.
They feel the same thing.
They feel the same thing. And they feel too that these men had so much to offer the world, and my husband had so much to offer his corner of the world, of course, but these were men who quite often were at the beginning of their careers and looking out on this expansive future that they had. Ronnie Van Zant is an example of that. I mean, they were they became very popular fairly quickly, mm-hmm. once they got a recording, and then it's all just gone. And so there is that unfairness.
That unfairness.
All the time.
So common.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Laurie Tucker Sullivan, it was really wonderful to have you here to talk about this really wonderful work that you've done. I really enjoyed reading through all of these stories, and again, learning about these women for the first time, but also learning so much about their relationships and with the men that they were married to. There were all kinds of wonderful gems in there that I hadn't been aware of before. So thank you for writing the book, and thank you for being here with us.
Well, thanks so much, Stephen. It's been great to talk with you.
That's it for Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes at WDET.org and make sure to subscribe to our podcast, where you can leave us a rating or a review. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. The audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.